And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am
I'm
David.
Travis.
Oh, yeah, we are joined by our special guest, Kathy Ferguson. It's been a while since you've been on the podcast, Kathy. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So since we might have some new listeners here who weren't here for the last one, why don't you tell everybody what you do and why you are relevant to our Star Trek discussion?
Well, I teach a class at the University of Hawaii in the Department of Political Science called Political Theory in Star Trek. And it, makes me spend a lot of time watching Star Trek, and I get to call it work.
Awesome.
And also, I have to proudly claim I raised two kids on Star Trek.
It's true. Although
Man, I wonder what kind of weirdos they turned out to be.
I have a
That's kind of weirdo.
complaint to file in that department is that you didn't expose me to nearly enough Deep Space Nine. I had to wait until college for that.
Oh, well,
Picky,
all
picky.
parents, we're fallible. What can I say?
Yeah.
It was all TNG all the time when I was growing up. But, TNG is great, but I didn't find my true love until college.
Or in some of us did not get a Star Trek upbringing, okay?
Yeah.
So you need to check your privilege right here and right now.
That's true. First world problems.
Also, to anyone listening who's joining us because I won them over at Geek Girl Con, I just want to say hey.
It's true. Grace was networking for us.
Sweet.
I don't have any.
Yeah.
Kappa.
Now I'm actually about the halfway point of business cards. I thought I'd never get rid of these things. All right.
That's what I'm here for, helping.
So our main
Helping.
topic for today is discussing Star Trek III: The Search for Spock.
More like the search for retcon.
Yeah, which as far as I'm concerned, the biggest takeaway from that is that Christopher Lloyd says "kapla" very strangely.
He's Christopher Lloyd. He says everything kind of strangely.
Like, David, did you notice when he says it, he says like a kapla. Like, he says it kind of choked off.
Well,
But I think he
it's
says.
in interesting that you bring that up because it's such a great movie, but I especially love it because we get so much Klingon
That's true.
awesomeness. And this is the debut movie, the debut pretty much everywhere, of Mark Okrand's Klingon language.
It's true.
Mark Okrand worked on The Wrath of Khan when he did the Vulcan language dialogue for Spock and Saavik, and he tells the story that he thought that was it. That's his time on Star Trek. He got to teach Spock how to speak Vulcan. He was done.
He
They
touched
bring
the
him back for
stars.
the Klingon, and he went to work. He incorporated James Doohan's gibberish type, Klingon from the motion picture. He made it into the language, but he says that out of all the actors, that have come into the Klingon realm, he considers Christopher Lloyd to be his like prototype, or not proto his like his essential Klingon. Like, that's
The
his best
template thing.
favorite. Yeah, archetype. There you go. That Klingon is supposed to be guttural. It was in the script that, he says guttural Klingon, so he had to make the language guttural. But that he also made the language that it was supposed to be, like, short, choppy, punchy, percussive. So Christopher Lloyd, basically, according to the creator of the language, is one of the best speakers and examples of the Klingon language.
So basically, it's the
There's
rest of
been.
us who are saying kapla weird then.
Somewhat. I mean, there's
Yeah.
definitely issues with, especially when Klingons go kapla and they drag out the A. You're not supposed to do that.
It's
But,
not supposed to sound like aloha. It's supposed to punch.
I'm imagining Hawaiian Klingons now, and it's amazing.
Yep. So it's fun.
Klingon pigeon would probably sound kind of weird, but okay. So a quick announcement before we get into anything else is that the Star Trek Continues Kickstarter is still going. Go give them money because they deserve it. They're pretty cool. And then we have one email to read before we get into the main topic of discussion. This one is, of course, from Christopher 13, and
Yay.
it says, to the hosts of the All Things Trek podcast. He calls it something else, but I'm going to skip that in joke for this point. It's been quite a while since I've been interested enough to send an email to you guys about subjects that were discussed, and while I would like to. Wait, hang on. I completely missed my train of thought there. It has been quite a while since I have been interested enough to send an email to you guys about subjects that were discussed, and while I would like to about the discussions of the first two movies, in light of this new shorter format of the podcast, I'll try to figure out a way to do it in one letter instead of making three essay length letters. I have a feeling I'll fail in such an attempt, but wish me luck on it anyway. However, I do want to address an observation. In the past, Oren has made an observation on the music of Star Trek III, where he compared it to the music of a particular scene to the music of a scene in the Aliens movies. He's talking about the scene when the Enterprise is flying towards the Bird of Prey, and they have that kind of dramatic music in the background.
Yeah, did James Horner do the music for both of them?
Yes, he did. And actually, that's basically what Christopher 13 points out, is that, because I had commented like a while back that I really liked the Star Trek III music, and then I watched Aliens and thought that they had ripped it off from Aliens.
No.
But I didn't, A, didn't realize they were the same composer, and B, I didn't realize that Star Trek III actually predates Aliens.
Oren.
It's something, I'm pretty positive I've actually made that point before, but I might not have, so he's just pointing that out. Anyway, although I intend to type my thoughts on Star Trek III and the previous two movies in the future, I thought I'd make this a short point for now, but I do have one final question for each of you. What are your plans for Halloween? I'm just curious to know if any of you have any at all for that day.
Ooh.
Well, I wish the show had remained a longer podcast. I still thank you guys and gal for still going on with it. Sincerely, Chris. Well, I can't speak for David or Grace, or maybe I can speak for Grace, but I'm going to be having a Halloween party that Lillian is putting together. It's going to be here at my apartment. It's going to be a grand old time.
Aside from that, I am going to be dressing up and handing out candy in the local shopping district here. All the shops and local businesses hand out candy to the kids. I'm dressing up as the Starbucks mermaid, so
cool.
Let's see if I can score some free coffee for that. Yeah? Yeah. And to get in the Halloween spirit, I have been obsessively listening to the Candy Coated Cackles playlists, which are great. You should totally look them up.
Oh, yeah.
They're Halloween-based playlists. They're on the KCK Halloween at Blogspot, and they're really fun playlists with great artwork and a great variety, and they're just really fun, I gotta say.
All right. Kathy, are you doing anything interesting for Halloween?
Yeah, I think I'll dress up like a college professor and give out candy.
Wow.
I like
broad
it.
Horizons.
It shows gumption. All right. Well, without further ado then, let's talk about Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. I like that, as was pointed out in the chat room, this is the unofficial sequel to Spock's Brain.
It's a much prettier sequel, though.
It is at that. Although, since we'll talk about visual and sound effects first, did you guys notice that this movie is a lot grayer than the last one?
Yeah, I'm thinking that's kind of a stylistic thing to sort of counter, this is my guess, to like kind of counteract the idea that they were, a lot of the previous movie was set on like this desert planet where there were lots of oranges and reds and stuff. That's just what I thought, maybe.
It looked more like the motion picture as I was watching it than it did Wrath of Khan. I mean, they still have the Wrath of Khan uniforms.
Yeah.
But the lighting is different. Like, everything looks a little bit more washed out.
Maybe that's just how Leonard Nimoy rolls as a director.
I suppose, because Leonard Nimoy is, in fact, the director of this movie. And I thought it was a clever little...
He directed several movies.
Mm-hmm. It was actually kind of clever. In the opening credits, he's not listed as an actor.
Yeah.
So, you know, makes you a little bit wonder. It's like, you know, you don't immediately know, yeah, he's going to be coming back as Spock, right?
They even put, like, a gap between Forrest Kelly and William Shatner's names in the credits where his name would be, but it doesn't come.
Huh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
That's creepy.
Yeah, watch it knowing that. You'll be waiting for it and it will never come.
There's also, this is the first time we see the introduction of the Klingon Bird of Prey.
That's true.
And there's apparently some kind of convoluted history about how it was originally supposed to be a Romulan ship. Then they decided it was going to be Klingon, and there was going to be some story about how the Klingons stole it. And then they were like, why is this plot line still in here? It doesn't really do anything. So they took that out. So now it's just a Klingon ship.
They decided to make it sort of a soft canon that the Klingons and the Romulans just share technology willy-nilly somehow.
Yeah, that was, you know, back
when... save money, much like the studio does.
Look, you know, in the pre, what was it, Kittimer? Yeah, the pre-Kittimer days were strange times. back when we were great friends.
The PK. Pre-Kittimer years.
Warren, I'm thinking about your point about the color.
Yeah.
And how maybe the what you called the gray was an important backdrop to the planet self-destructing, because it's not throughout the movie. When they get to Vulcan, everything's kind of pink, right? Because it's Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're on Earth, you know, everything is, you know, looks like the cafe, looks like the station. It's not doesn't seem to have that coloration. So I'm wondering if this was a way to code. It seems like there's a lot of, maybe all movies have this, but I see in this movie a lot of ways of coding different kinds of plot turns or character development. And maybe the gray was to code the background for Genesis.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
Yeah, maybe.
Especially also because, you know, this is the supposed to be when they're recovering from or still hurting from the death of Spock.
Yeah.
So you have a much more, you know, a much more somber atmosphere. Whereas in Star Trek II, they were very like, things were very like, we have to, you know, we have to fight to defend ourselves or we'll die sort of story.
Yeah.
So everything was much higher energy. Although the Klingon Bird of Prey bridge design is a little bit weird. Like, did you notice, like, the inside, you've got Krug sitting on top of this platform and this, like, pit around him?
Yes.
That was just,
it's meant to be a dramatic cockpit. He definitely had that. It was definitely designed to make Krug the center of attention.
That's true.
Which doesn't really make it look like much of an actual cockpit, so.
Yeah. I don't know if I would want a bridge like that, though, because it would be so easy to fall into that pit.
Yeah.
Just, you know, with the way that Star Trek ships rock and roll around all day.
Maybe the Klingons have seat belts for once.
Well, there were many things about the relationships of the Klingon crew that sort of defies any possible functioning in space.
Yeah.
So this is just one of them.
Well, what else? What did you mean? What else were you talking about?
Disciplining your crew by killing them is problematic. And shooting them when you're flying in space and you might shoot through your ship is a little problematic. It seems like having his little altar there that he somehow has to leap over the moat to get onto, that's the least of his problems. He's killing his crew off.
Yeah, one assumes there's like a gangplank in the back of behind his chair that he can walk over, but maybe he just has to jump every time.
I don't know. We kind of see him make a lot of questionable decisions throughout the course of the movie, so.
That's true.
Maybe the epitomal Klingon is just not a very good decision maker. No offense, David.
Well, he was the Klingon, the actor as the speaker. I don't know about, you know, Krug in general, but I thought you could kind of see off to the side there was a rope and you kind of just swing across to get to your maybe not.
He's Tarzan
like.
You have to get a running jump when you're coming onto the bridge. So,
but what about his dog that he's like got up on the dais with him and stuff?
Oh yeah, monster dog.
It's unprofessional to bring your pet into the workplace.
Well, everyone calls him my lord. We're on the subject of Krug a little early, but we'll roll with it. Everyone calls him my lord instead of captain, which is like kind of strange because the Klingons have never before or since really used that title. It was like some kind of samurai or like a feudal, you know, baron or something. So
maybe my lord was his pet name.
Maybe it's just kind of, I guess, I think the implication of him having his dog on the bridge is that he's more of a noble than a military captain, right? So he doesn't have to act as professional as some of, you know, as his Starfleet counterparts. You know, not to say this is the movie where they act the most professionally.
Either way, it's, you know, not clean or professional, or who's gonna pick up the weird dog poop, I ask you. Maybe that's what the pit is for.
Oh dear.
Just shovel it off into there.
Well, it's, you know, it's that guy whose job it was to feed the dog, and it was like this sort of like this kind of dramatic moment where he's like, "You feed my dog," and then like the camera like turns and the guy's got this like, "Oh god," expression on his face.
Exactly. That's clearly not a good job to have.
No, apparently not.
Not if you want to keep all your fingers and yeah. I always kind of thought that was weird because, you know, Krug is like, you know, scratching it or petting it, and it seems to be fine. And then that guy's like scared of it. So I figure maybe it goes into like shark-style feeding frenzy or something.
Well, there's a reason Krug didn't want to feed it himself. So
I thought he was just lazy.
Before we completely leave the topic of visuals and sound effects and you know, special effects and such, what about the Genesis planet? What do you guys think about that?
The Genesis planet looks beautiful. It looks really interesting. I think it was just really... That's part of what makes the movie visually for me is the Genesis planet and just how it looks and the sort of dramatic effect we get when we see it.
What about you, Kevin?
In honor of your podcast theme, I just watched all 6 of the original Star Trek movies in order.
Good Lord!
And this is professional research on my part. I just have to take the time. And what I noticed is that the special effects when the basically big columns of stone come bursting up through the earth, it looks a lot like Star Trek V.
Yeah.
That happens on that planet too. This is somebody's idea of how to make a really dramatic looking planet is to have giant columns of earth flinging themselves upward through the crust. And then in the case of Genesis, followed by lots of flames.
Mimetic thought process or same production designer? You be the judge.
Yeah, or, you know, they had a little leftover footage and, decided to go with it.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, it could have been an airbender was off camera and they were bringing... Wait, never mind.
That would have been an earthbender, David. God.
Always. God.
There you go. Well, I'm the avid... Right, yeah. Okay. I need to watch more of that, but... The Genesis planet, to me, I liked it when I remember, you know, back when I first saw it and all the time since. It's a cool planet, but at the same time, I kind of looked at it as a bigger, I mean, not necessarily bigger in terms of like, you know, square footage, but just they went bigger with the classic TOS style sets whenever they would beam down to a planet and you could tell that it was on a soundstage. Mm-hmm. This time there's like more plants, more stuff in the foreground, background, and the lighting and the color. I just thought it was, you know, and then when it starts shaking and going crazy, I thought that was a cool planet, but it's not around for too long.
While we're still on the topic of Genesis, how about that opening sequence where we get like those big sweeping views of the planet and the clouds with this big bursting James Horner score? Which seems a little weird with the introduction that we got right before that, just showing the footage from Wrath of Khan. It felt like they had 2 different ideas for how to start the movie and just kind of mashed them together.
Yeah, a little bit. What with, like, the everything is sad because Spock is dead, and then the, look at this beautiful new planet.
Beautiful planet and James Horner music.
That was actually a very, I may be over... attributing motive here where none was, but to me that was very clever juxtaposition because that's the film had to bring together the sadness of Spock is dead and the joy of Spock's alive. And so juxtaposing those 2 scenes visually, I thought was a way to foreshadow the unfolding of the plot.
At that point though, it's not so much Spock is alive as Spock is alive. Question.
Right. But it unfolds. But the 2 scenes sort of, to me, they set up the viewer to be prepared to combine the grief and sadness and the discovery.
Mm-hmm. So we had a request in the chat room to talk about the Excelsior and what that looked like on the inside. And I got to say, as I was watching this movie, something stuck in my mind. And I was like, the inside of this bridge looks like the inside of a Star Trek Online bridge, which is to say it's big enough that I could play football in it. It's huge. Like, did you see?
Your MMO, man. You play it the way you want.
It's just such a big bridge. And I'm like, why does it...
I got a mariachi crew on my bridge. What are you doing with yours?
It's like, why does
it... I had a piece of that space.
Yeah, Kathy?
I had a thought about that, too, that there's something silly about the Excelsior.
Yeah.
And it goes with what I think is this at least this is what I thought on like the third viewing when I'd stopped thinking about the story and started looking at how they told the story, mm-hmm. is it's a very campy movie. It has lots of over-the-top exaggeration in it. It ridicules different people and things. It's very parodic. You know, it parodies things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It goes to this extreme of ostentation. So here's this giant Excelsior ship that's so overdone that it's silly. And that allows Scotty to be able to sabotage it. And then to deliver his great line, the more they fancy it up, the easier it is to, I don't know, screw up the plumbing or whatever he said.
Yeah, the more they overdo the plumbing, the easier it is to stop up the drain.
There you go. That's what he said. And yet they can't, they manage that well, because if they went too far with it, then first of all, why would Starfleet have made a ship that was totally ridiculous? And second, how could Sulu end up commanding?
To annoy Scotty, just to purely annoy Scotty.
Well, as you can see,
well, in this case, in this case, like you're saying, over the top and parody, the captain is, you know, easy to, you know, poke fun at and not take too seriously. And he's the only one, almost a caricature to some degree, but he's the only one that ever carries that scepter. Like, where did that come from? And we never see that again. What did it actually do?
Yeah, the Starfleet issue pimp stick. What is that?
Well, hang on. I'll talk about that thing in a minute, because I looked this up. I have researched that thing. But so, Kathy, what do you think? USS Excelsior, a commentary on wasteful military spending?
Yeah, possibly. but they can't go too far with that, because Sulu ends up in charge of it. And so, and, you know, it can't be ridiculed to the point that it's not attractive.
Well, the first thing that Sulu apparently did, if you notice what it looked like in Star Trek VI, is get some interior redecorating going on.
Well, wouldn't you?
Right, because, I mean, the bridge in Star Trek VI looks nothing like the bridge that
we saw. He also gets, like, fancy china brought on and stuff for his team.
Well, I mean, you know, Captain's prerogative on that one, but it looks like a functioning bridge and not this huge, like, indoor stadium with a bunch of people sitting in it.
And Sulu's got much sort of nicer dramatic lighting to it and stuff.
Yeah. And, I mean, Kathy, you were talking about the whole thing looking kind of silly. I actually think we could probably rank the movies based on what I call their Starfleet silliness quota.
Uh-huh.
Because Starfleet...
is much too silly.
Well, because Starfleet, in the original series, right, pretty much almost any time we saw a Starfleet official who was not Kirk, they were silly and kind of incompetent. Like, you know,
they were doing the whole "what's all this thing" thing.
Yeah, I mean, Starfleet is apparently full of incompetent commodores, according to the original series. You know, and ambassadors and other.
They get anything done.
Yeah, and I think
Kirk is really just holding the whole place together.
It's been speculated before that the reason for that is because Roddenberry was having all these problems with the networks, and so all of those people represent the networks just coming in and messing everything up.
Art imitating life.
Right. But in the movies, there's like a certain like curve that the movies follow as to how silly the rest of Starfleet is. Like, they're a little silly in the motion picture, and then in Wrath of Khan, they're like not silly at all. Starfleet is serious business in Wrath of Khan.
Dead serious.
And then in Star Trek III, it's like everything except for the main characters is a parody of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And
I actually think there's a reason for that. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead with your analysis, Orin. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's pretty much the end of it. Like in Star Trek, you know, Star Trek IV, they get a little less silly, and then Star Trek V doesn't count. And then in Star Trek VI, they're, you know, back to being a serious space organization.
Such as they are.
So it was just something that I noticed was interesting. Go ahead, Kathy.
And I think that's a rhetorical device that's quite interesting and functions well for them, because when Starfleet needs to be to play a role as either admirable or threatening, as like when the Starfleet sends somebody to take Data's daughter away, then you know they're scary and awful.
I hate that guy.
But yet at the same time, there's enough goofiness that it allows Kirk and the gang to be kind of Robin Hood and his Merry Men.
Kirk and the gang.
There has to be a way to set this up so that Kirk can continuously rebel against Starfleet and not ever really get punished.
Yeah.
And so they had to have some rhetorical devices that let us imagine Starfleet in a way that made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of them is, in this movie, you never identify with anybody who represents Starfleet outside of the crew itself. They're all silly, effeminate, not brave, not manly.
They're pretty.
Or or just caricatures. Remember, there's that tall security guy that tells Sulu, "Don't call
smart,
he calls him tiny."
Yep.
Don't call me tiny.
Remember, there's that one when Kirk is asking, I forget their rank and his name, but he's asking that one Starfleet official, like, give me back the Enterprise because I need to go take Spock back to Vulcan. And he's like, no, you know, it's you know, you're not going to get it, basically. He tells Kirk while he's saying, no, the Enterprise, you're not getting it back. I don't believe in all this. He goes, the Enterprise can't take the pounding. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, it's damaged. Okay, but you're just going from Earth to Vulcan. What pounding is the Enterprise going to take? You know, you're not going into battle. You're not going to the Klingons.
Maybe they just messed it up that bad during Wrath of Khan.
It's like, you know, the only thing holding the ship together is like a bunch of twine that Scotty has tied together in the engine room.
The only thing holding it together is Scotty's reserve. That's it.
And Scotty's already told Kirk that he can fix it in 2 weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not irremediably damaged.
I mean, this is the same admiral who tells Kirk that his career stands for rationality.
Right. Has nothing to do with his career.
Yeah.
So, are we talking about the same Captain Kirk here?
Yeah.
Rational. Wow.
In the chat room, we have Make T-Not War reminding us that his name is Admiral Morrow. Although sometimes he's called Commander Morrow because he's the commander of Starfleet. That was a little confusing for me.
Either way, he's kind of got an awesome Reed Richards style mini afro going there with the great temples that kept distracting me.
And one thing I think might be going on with that character is that he's talking to Kirk, who is basically Starfleet's biggest celebrity, right? And he's been told you cannot let Kirk take the ship back to Genesis. But, you know, he's basically he's talking to a rock star, so he's just making up excuses. He's really nervous. He's just like, yeah, well, the ship might fall apart. I mean, you don't know. Like, last time you took it out, you fell into a wormhole that had an asteroid in it, and what if that happened again?
But also, that speech when Kirk goes to try to get permission to take the ship and doesn't get it, that speech let Starfleet, first of all, let the guy look unappealing.
Yeah.
So as a viewer, you don't identify with him. You know, you want Kirk to steal the ship because his boss is a jerk. And also it gives the admiral a chance to give another speech that makes reason and emotion opposites.
Yes.
That either you have a career of reason or you careen off into the world of crazy emotion. It's either rationality or intellectual chaos. And, you know, of course, everything that the compelling characters do combines those things. And yet they keep, when they philosophize about it or when they talk about it in any way, they pretend as though it somehow makes sense to completely separate those.
Yeah, that's the thing that I've noticed a few times in Star Trek's kind of strange, like, philosophical view. Gray, sorry, did I cut you off?
Yeah, I was wondering if just in this movie, maybe that's not a reflection of that kind of, you know, logic versus emotion thing that they're always pushing with the character of Spock, who isn't really around for this movie. So maybe that was their way of Spockifying it up.
Keep the theme going. Yeah.
Yeah, you need somebody to fill the role of Kirk. Don't do that thing. I'm going to do that thing.
Okay, I'll help you do the thing.
So, you know, you need someone to fill that role.
You can't just have DeForest Kelly talking to himself, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Although that is pretty great.
Quick comment on the costumes before we really get into the characters too much is I think this is also the first time we saw the Klingon silver armor.
It is, isn't it?
Which I thought was kind of neat.
Well, it was an expansion, and they did more with it because in the motion picture, when Mark Leonard was the Klingon commander and they fire their torpedoes at the V'ger cloud, they have the very like rudimentary beginning of that type of Klingon armor, but we don't get a good look at it. We really just get a look at him like from the chest up, and you know, some of the shots of the, you know, to some degree the Klingons behind him. Whereas with Christopher Lloyd and his crew, we get to see like the full body of it. They've updated the armor and the around the neck and the shoulders, and we get to see the whole uniform. And then they differentiated. You could tell there's like, you know, the lower ranking ones versus Christopher Lloyd as the captain commander. And so they definitely expanded on the Klingon uniforms.
Oh, and you guys wanted to know about that little scepter thing? All right, so prepare to have some knowledge laid on you.
He's going to drop the knowledge.
So that thing that, that Captain Stiles is holding is called a swagger stick.
It's appropriate.
Yeah, and it exists for two purposes. It originated back in ye old Roman Empire days, and you carried it both so that everyone would know you were cool, because only cool people could carry one, and to beat people who you didn't like.
It really is a pimp stick. I was right. Oh my god.
Well, I find this disappointing because I thought it was a riding crop.
That was pretty cool, but no.
I interpreted that whole that scene with the captain of the Excelsior that he was supposed to look like an effeminate British army officer from a World War One sort of era.
Yeah.
You know, the riding boots.
I could see that.
And you know, the way you tuck the thing that I wanted to call a riding crop under the arm and walk briskly with your riding boot heels clicking on the floor. That's a parody of World War One sort of British proper men.
Stiff upper lippishness.
Right.
Yes.
And you could very well be right that that might have been the way that he was playing it, right? And if you look at some of the pictures of even into World War II, there are a lot of American generals that have one. it's just this stick that they carry. Theoretically, I don't think they used it to beat, you know, insubordinate officers and men anymore. But
and they're also not getting on horses.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they don't really need a riding crop.
If you don't have one of those and have a cane, a sword hidden in the cane somehow, I'm completely disappointed.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's wasted potential right there.
And in this case, it's not just a, I mean, it's got like a leather bound, you know, portion, and then you could see metal, and but it's not just a stick. On the end of it, it looks like there's some kind of bit of technology or some kind of gizmo, like, you know, there it's like it's supposed to do something, but he never does anything with it. And it's like, you know, what is that for? Is, I don't know. It was just weird.
Maybe that's where Ruby Rod got his microphone in The Fifth Element.
No, hey, I've got it. Maybe that's where he keeps his nail file. Because you remember when that scene opens, he's laying in bed filing his nails.
With what looks like a harmonica. Like, I was just like, what is that?
He's got to do everything the hard way.
So just, this guy files his nails with a musical instrument. Okay. this guy is just out there.
Issues.
In the one of the novels, apparently the backstory of the swagger stick is revealed. I forget what the name of the novel was, but in one of the novels, Captain Stiles supposedly took that stick off of a Klingon whom he bested in single combat. You can imagine Captain Stiles besting a Klingon in single combat.
That's not going to happen.
Must have been drunk Klingon. And then, can you imagine a Klingon carrying one of those things?
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem...
the most effeminate of all the Klingons.
I don't even know if I would say effeminate, because, like, I mean, I'm sort of...
not the feyest of the Klingons.
I'm sort of, I don't know, I always kind of get bothered by using effeminate as a pejorative, because it, but you know, it's definitely not, doesn't really fit with the Klingon mystique, right?
The swishiest of the Klingons, I don't know.
Sure. All right. Okay. So, moving.
And can we say something else about the costumes of the women?
Yeah. What about them?
Well, Krug's girlfriend at the very beginning when she brings these disreputable-looking guys in their disreputable-looking ship to meet the cloaked Klingon ship.
Oh dear.
And she's dressed like a barbarian princess, but yet she went on an away mission to purchase Genesis.
She looks like she's some kind of John Carter of Mars-themed stripper.
And then, this is just another example of Krug's treatment of his crew would leave him crewless quickly, right? Is that she gets killed because she saw the Genesis data. Now, how much forethought would it have taken to just tell her, don't look at it?
Yeah.
Or
she could have lied.
Right, or she could have not brought it up. I mean, she offered this information.
Right.
Or he could have let her live because the two guys on the ship that he showed it to, he didn't kill them.
Right, and also one of them even didn't give him the answer he wanted.
Right,
He was like, what do you guys think? And one of them was like, I don't know how cool this thing is. And he was like, you're not a good guy. Get out of here. Instead of being like, well, I have to murder you now.
Well, it goes even a step further.
So ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then it was echoed at the end with the Vulcan version of Vestal Virgins who are hanging out on Mount Celea.
Yeah.
And they have this sort of Egyptian shape to them. If you look at the way they hold their arms, it's at right angles, and the way that you know, that Egyptian figures often are held to be dancing because the art didn't have the same kind of perspectivism that we're used to. And so it looks like everybody's at a right angle to themselves. So here's these women with the long hair and the white robe and these oddly held arm gestures. And I thought, what? And they stand there the whole, like, they overnight, right, with their with the
better to do
the woman who's who's in charge of making the transference happen between to Spock, put Spock's Katra back. And, you know, I just thought, this is not the most practical form of dress for these jobs that these women are doing. But of course, that goes with Star Trek a lot, right?
Well, so
practicality in women's clothing, what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, and you can roll that up into the whole, like, extreme silliness angle of the Vulcan mysticism, right? Because, I mean, I'm okay with the idea of Vulcans having mysticism and spirituality, but they definitely seem to have a bunch of very out there costumes and trappings on their rituals for a...
It is at peak silliness in this movie.
Yeah. It's like they saw that they were kind of silly in Amok Time, and they were like, we could turn that up to 11.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which just goes totally with my feeling about this movie, that one of the reasons it works, and I do like this movie, I like it better every time I see it, is how they use camp to make the thing that's supposed to be serious look silly, and to allow the things that might be silly to be serious. Huh. They use it for irony.
I think they use that to best effect in the scene where McCoy is in the bar and trying to get spaceship, and it's like he's trying to be serious, but everyone's like, "Why, you can't go to Genesis?" And he's like, "Well, now I'm gonna nerve pinch you." And they're like, "Dude, you're not a Vulcan." And he's all like, "Oh, dang."
Well, plus, you get to enjoy a Star Wars bar scene in Star Trek,
right? That's always good.
Exactly.
What was that, David?
And the waitress, you were talking about, you know, impractical and, you know, crazy outfits. The way she was dressed and her makeup and her hair, and, you know, it's the camp. It's like, you know, almost like, so what's your poison? It's like, where's the logic in ordering poison? It was just, you know, like you said, it's supposed to be a serious, dramatic time or a moment, and it's played for, like, laughs and lightness.
Although I'll give her some slack because, you know, she is in a bar and theoretically is supposed to be drawing the customer's eye, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, so, you know, with her, it kind of makes sense that she's in this super, you know, somebody's idea of sexy outfit. With the Klingon.
But wouldn't it be...
Oh, you would have to be a very special kind of somebody to find that a sexy outfit.
Yeah.
This might be a bit of a retcon or looking at it different than intended, but it's Starfleet, right? Wouldn't it be Synthahol? Like, are they really getting drunk? Or I mean, I don't know what they're Synthahol, ordering.
Yeah.
They really go back and forth on if Synthahol can get you drunk or not. Like... Yep. There are some episodes where it does, and some episodes where it doesn't.
They established when Scotty came on TNG that they were still drinking, like, real alcohol back then, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, that probably...
Well, Scotty was. and McCoy's medical-grade Romulan ale.
Right. Although, I actually did like the bar scene because it followed up on an establishment in Wrath of Khan where McCoy mentioned he had smuggling connections. That was how we got the Romulan ale.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I could have done with
the McCoy, dirty deeds done dirt cheap.
You know, I could have done without the, you know, to you our planet welcome guy. Like, that took it a little bit farther than I thought it needed to go. But, like, I appreciated that they followed up that he, in fact, has some black market connections. And one other thing about the costumes. Did you notice something? This is something that they would never get away with in a modern movie. Two of the main characters are wearing pink.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Kirk has a pink shirt, and Chekhov is wearing, like, a pink, I don't know what to call it, like a pink jacket or something.
Pantsuit.
Yeah. It's something I noticed.
Wait a minute, we're talking about costumes. Do you guys remember, like, what was Chekhov wearing? It had, like, this really white collar. He almost looked like a little Dutch boy. I don't know what to call it. It was
more so
Chekhov. I'm like, really, Chekhov?
And Sulu basically has a cape on. You know, his jacket has the swing to it that's very cape-like.
With the Mandarin collar, though, he just looks really super fly.
Well, he's definitely got a sense of style. You know, no question.
Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of these characters, go ahead, David.
But Uhura just gets the maroon uniform. She didn't get a good outfit.
Wasted potential. Oh no, we get to see her wearing some of her, you know, big, crazy.
That's right. When Sarek, when they're commemorating and celebrating, and Sarek first comes in, and she's got this giant gold necklace on. It's like, you know, I remember that now.
Yeah. Now, speaking of these characters, I want to talk about the characters from the show. And that's actually the first thing that comes to my mind, is that I was really confused and disappointed that they decided to take Uhura out of the movie, like, a third of the way in. It's like,
she had that much to do in the previous one either, so.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is like, okay, so in the last movie, pretty much everybody but Uhura got something cool to do.
Yeah.
And in this movie, we can make up for that, and not really. I mean, I guess she has her scene with Lieutenant Adventure, which granted, you know, made me laugh, but maybe wasn't like the really like the hard hitting moment that Uhura needed.
No. At least we get to see her be also funny in the next movie.
Say what now?
We get to see her be funny in the next movie at least.
That's true.
Oh, they make up for that. But we also get a brief glimpse of Janice Rand when the Enterprise is first getting into dock.
Uh-huh.
So that was kind of nice.
I thought they were going to go somewhere with that when I first saw it. I'm like, hey, it's Rand! Oh, now she's gone.
Yeah, but it was to give us the joy of that recognition.
Yeah.
Although this is the second time that they brought Rand in and didn't give her any lines. I guess they couldn't afford a speaking role for, what is it, Jennifer Lee Whitney, I think is her name?
Grace Whitney.
Grace Lee Whitney, right. So they.
And yeah, and then she shows up again in Star Trek VI without any lines.
No, she has lines in Star Trek VI. Not as many as she was supposed to, because she was supposed to be in another scene, but they switched her for somebody else. But she does have lines. Okay, so Uhura, that kind of disappointed me. But aside from Uhura, I thought the other characters all got a pretty good treatment in this movie. Like, you know, especially like Sulu and Chekhov, at least they don't get to do a whole lot, but when they are there, it's kind of neat to see them being like, you know, yes, we're loyal to Captain Kirk, you know, we are prepared to throw away our careers to save Spock, as it were.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I mean, you know, getting to see Sulu beat the crap out of
friendship him. Go.
And McCoy's role was great. He gets the best role here, I think.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Like, I think McCoy is probably the star actor of this movie. Although maybe Shatner when he finds out that David is dead. That's the other part.
Yeah.
Which is.
But I also thought it was really interesting, and this goes with the sort of campy theme that I keep seeing. Mm-hmm. Is there were numerous shots of intimacy between men in this movie,
mm-hmm.
and
we get so a lot of punch.
There's one shot where Kirk is holding McCoy. Remember when he finds McCoy in Spock's quarters early on?
Yeah.
And McCoy collapses in Kirk's arms and Kirk holds him and calls for the medics. And that same visual relationship is repeated when they're on the Jennison planet and Kirk holds Spock and figures out how to say beam us up in Klingon so that they can get beamed up to ship.
Yeah.
And it's photogenically similar. The angle of the camera is Kirk standing facing the camera, and Spock or Bones, depending on which scene it is collapsed into Kirk's arms, and Kirk is rescuing them. And I just thought that's such clever camera work to symbolize the whole theme. It's basically a buddy movie, and Kirk is having to rescue his friends. And career be damned.
And that's really a recurring theme of the movie, is this kind of like sense of intimacy, interpersonal or no. We get all of these sort of forced close-ups that are really uncomfortable between characters, like when the Klingons are all just kind of smushed together, or when Spock's dad is doing a mind meld on Kirk's. Yeah. It's something we just keep kind of seeing in the movie.
Uh-huh.
And when
Krug shows the Genesis information to his two crewmen, and one of them totally disappoints him by actually observing that you could create planets, and the other one, you know, is meets his expectations because he notices that it's a weapon.
Yeah.
And so Krug dismisses the first guy instead of killing him like he did the woman, and then leans over very, very close, and they have this very intimate whispering that's also got this lingering eye contact in it. And so, you know, there's, again, another moment of a kind of campy closeness that helps you, first
and
of
at
all...
at that point...
Go ahead.
And that's another example of the, my lord, you know, he, that whispery closeness. It's like, yes, my lord.
Uh-huh.
It's also kind of cool because Scotty just gets to be a, an old curmudgeon in this episode, which James Doohan is surprisingly good at.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I don't have time. I don't have time for the Excelsior. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill to the warp core both ways.
Yeah, and if my grandma had wheels,
get those Klingons off my lawn.
Yeah, the if my grandmother had wheels line.
And if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a wagon.
And then there's like you were mentioning close-ups. There's another sequence like when McCoy has broken into Spock's quarters and Kirk doesn't know who it is, and he like grabs him and kind of. Yeah, he kind of spins them around and, like, holds... Again, there's a lot of really of close-ups, shots that I I didn't really think about it until now, but it's definitely there.
Yep, a lot of close-ups and a lot of touching.
Mm-hmm. And he also, did you notice when they're all down on the Genesis planet, you have kind of Kirk standing off by himself, and then you have the rest of the cast kind of huddled together, like a Greek chorus or something? Like, they're all standing in, like, a huddle. Which made it very convenient for when, you know, Krug was like, everyone except Kirk, go over there, because they were all already basically where he wanted them to go.
It also seemed like if you had just called up and insulted the Klingon commander in the hopes of provoking him to come down, that you wouldn't then all turn your backs on the same direction. Wouldn't you be, like, getting ready for that? You know, the guy's going to be down, he's going to be armed.
Yeah. I'm honestly not clear what Kirk's plan was at that point. Like, I don't know if he was hoping to overpower Krug or if he was hoping that he would could convince Krug to beam them all up.
Yeah, that was my theory.
I guess he figured he'd just improvise or something.
Yeah. And I was actually going to say, even though I don't really think Kirk the character makes a very good showing in this movie, I really think Shatner makes one of his better showings as an actor.
That's true. I mean, even in the scene where he finds out about David's death, he kind of kills it, so... Well,
right, and that's actually part of the point, is that, like, the script kind of has Kirk act like nothing happened when his son dies. Like, you know, he's sad for a couple minutes, and then he kind of gets over it.
Yeah.
Whereas Shatner, in the moments, in the scenes where he's actually allowed to be upset, actually carries those moments.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, as
and also...
Yeah, go ahead, Kat.
Earlier, when, in the very beginning, when the death of Spock is still haunting Kirk, Shatner very adeptly plays that in the way he carries his body. Like, there's a moment where he goes and he puts his hand on the back of Spock's empty chair and talks about how he's haunted by the death of Spock. And then he walks into the turbolift.
Feels empty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when he walks into the turbolift, he almost crashes into the side for a minute as his grief, just a wave of grief hits him. And then he gathers his body up and, you know, resumes his disciplined self-presentation, but you know, it was very short. It was a few seconds, but it was really well done.
Yeah.
Well, I think, and that also was continued in, and we talked about the scene at the very beginning where we see the death of Spock scene again, and it starts, you know, really small, and it comes in. I think it's even black and white, and then it turns, as it gets bigger, it turns to color. I looked at that as showing, not just reminding the fans, like, hey, remember the last movie? I kind of took it as showing, like, that is still relevant. It's still, like, weighing over the crew, especially Kirk. Then, like you mentioned, the sadness where he's like, it feels like all the children have left the house, and he's like feeling that sadness in the turbo lift. And then here comes Sarek to do the mind meld. And when the death of David, you know, Kirk really shows it, like, you know, emotes. But with the Sarek scene, it was more subtle, but you still got to see, like, Kirk reacting, like he's reliving that memory. And,
exactly.
You know,
and
bringing up the sadness again.
Mm-hmm. He whispers no in a way that was much more effective than yelling it.
Yeah.
As he relives his grief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I felt like I wanted to point that out because it's easy to give Shatner, you know, a hard time for his acting. But I thought that in this movie he did a particularly good job, especially because he was not really supported by the script. Like, the script wasn't helping him in a lot of those cases. But I'd like to talk about...
Many years ago, when the first series was being talked about and there were no other series, somebody observed, some critic observed that William Shatner is really good at what they called at the time light comedy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of condescending to call it that. But nonetheless, he is very good at these sort of briskly ironic one-liners that move the plot along, but are both funny and, you know, ridiculous. Like, I didn't get permission to go, I'm going anyway, you know, never mind my career. And he is good at that.
All right.
He has good delivery, which helps.
It's true. All right, so let's talk about some of the side characters, which, in my opinion, I think this is where the movie really crashes. Because we have Captain I Can't Pick My Nose Without Asking Starfleet, Esteban. And I mean, seriously, if I was the guy in charge of that dude, like, if I was, you know, the Commodore in charge of his sector, I'd be like, dude, you are captain of a starship. You don't have to call me every 5 minutes to ask what to do. If that was the case, we wouldn't have you.
Right, you know it.
Say, what was that, Grace?
You just know he asks for permission to go on bathroom breaks.
It's
just,
you know, honestly, what it felt like. It's like this captain who, he has no decisiveness to him whatsoever. It's like, you know, when the Klingon bird of prey decloaks, he's like, stand by for evasives. And it's like, no, evasive right now. They're about to start shooting you.
Right.
How long are you going to stand by on that?
And then when David and Savick beam down, you know, he's kind of like, he's not asking permission from Starfleet at that point, but you could kind of tell, like, maybe the opinion and review of Starfleet is in his mind, because they're beaming down to an unknown, like, they know it's the Genesis planet, but they don't really know what's down there. The planet, it would be unstable. There's all this weather going on. And he tells them, you know, be careful down there, because I'm the one that's out on a limb here. It's like, really?
We're sitting up in this.
Yeah, we'll remember that. Great.
Yep. And a couple of times, let's go by the book. Let's go by the book. But in contrast to Orin thinking of them as failed characters, I think that Esteban and the captain of the Excelsior and the Admiral that we already talked about were three not admirable. It was important for them to be representatives of Starfleet who were not manly. They weren't admirable. They weren't heroic. They weren't strong. They weren't saving their friends at all costs. They were cautious bureaucrats by the book. And I think that's important because it allows the audience to root for Kirk, of which we would do, of course, and want him to succeed at the cost of defying authority. In fact, you know, that's part of the pleasure, is that he defies authority, he gets away with it. And yet, not just break from Starfleet entirely, as you have those three guys are so lame, and they needed to be lame, so that the heroic guys could look heroic.
They're kind of straw men in that sense, aren't they?
Yeah,
they're just
there to
make them look good.
Yeah, they were figures.
Easily, you know, dismissible.
They were tropes rather than real characters.
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying, Kathy, but for me, I feel like if the way you have to make your main characters look good is by making the people around them look bad, like, it's like, yes, if we make these people look like absolute tools, Kirk will look cooler by comparison. I think you're right. That is what they were doing. But it's, I don't know, I didn't like it.
Well, I think the reason that it worked for me here is that it wasn't just any other, I mean, that strategy of making your guy look good by making other people look bad is a kind of weak strategy, but the reason it worked here is that they weren't just any side characters, they were Starfleet. And Kirk has to continually rebel against Starfleet and continually be taken back into the fold afterwards. You know, so he's like Robin Hood all through the episode, and then he gets to go back and be embraced by the king.
He's got a level of puckishness he needs to maintain.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Kirk never really interacted with Esteban so much, but each of those three characters you mentioned represent authority, because in two cases, it's Kirk dealing with admirals, or, you know, in that level, but In the case of Esteban, he's the authority figure over David and Savick. So it's like you're always looking at them as, you know, you're not supporting or investing yourself into the figure of authority. You're looking right at the characters that are off doing stuff.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. It's that's a way to portray the figures of authority is slightly ridiculous, and therefore our crew it's good to rebel against them. But it never comes to breaking with Starfleet. There is that line where Kirk says, "I intend to recommend you all for promotion in whatever fleet we end up serving." And yet, like with all the movies, Starfleet is always, in the end, worth going back to.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that they are already prepared that they're going to take responsibility, right? They aren't like, hey, we're going to do this, and then we're going to fly off into the great unknown.
Off into the sequel!
Now, so we've got, you know, Captain Esteban and Captain Hoity Toity, whose Styles is actually his name. And then we've got David and Savick are the other two, like, prime kind of guest characters, and they really upset me. I thought that this was such a letdown, because David and Savick were established in Wrath of Khan, and they were still kind of, you know, nebulous. We didn't know a whole lot about them.
Nope.
And this was their movie to really, you know, show why we should care.
And we don't really get shown, do we?
No, we really get nothing. Like, we've got some nonsensical scenes where Savick scolds David about how the using protomatter, because, like, this is all his fault somehow. And it's, like, it's not really. Nothing that has happened at this point is David's fault. And then David is, like, kind of there. The only moment he really gets to stand out is when he tries to fight that one Klingon who was going to stab Savick. And that is the scene that, when I watch it, it makes my blood boil. Because Savick does nothing. She just stands there. And it's like, this is the scene where Savick should have done something. She should have sprung into action. Like, both because it would have made us think Savick was cool, and because it made sense for her character, because it was the most logical time to do anything.
And on the note of characters making sense, where the hell is Carol Marcus?
Yeah, there's that too.
Shouldn't she be, you know, checking out Genesis and stuff? It's kind of her project, so.
Well, that kind of ties into a thing that I thought watching these again, like over the years, or, you know, multiple viewings. In Wrath of Khan, David is very, like, in a way, anti-Starfleet, you know, yes, because they're scientists and they're the military. They always take our, you know, science things and turn it into a weapon. And then in this movie, he's on a starship. He's on a Starfleet ship. Like, I always thought, like, did he join the crew? Like, why is he on the starship now? Except I used to try to maybe rationalize it, like, well, maybe, you know, he called Kirk that overgrown Boy Scout, but then in the course of that movie, he might have, like, seen, okay, there's some value to Starfleet. But does that mean he would go, like, you know, join up on a ship? I mean, he's not in a Starfleet uniform, but he's a Federation scientist on the...
I took that as that they were delivering him and Savick to Genesis to do this scientific exploration. But I do think you're pointing to a really important character inconsistency that made David less interesting, and that is in the earlier movie, he's very political. He knows that Starfleet is going to take science and weaponize it, and he's against that. And yet in this movie, he says to Kirk, Genesis doesn't work. I can't believe they'd kill us for it. Where all around him is the example of exactly why the Klingons wanted it. It's a weapon. And so where did his political acumen go? Why doesn't he till the end realize that they have to keep the Klingons from getting it at all costs, because it's not a good planet making technology, but it's a great planet destroying technology.
Right.
Yeah. It seemed unfortunate is that they had potential with those characters and they kind of wasted them. We've still got plenty to talk about and we're at the hour mark. Do we need a break, guys? Take a quick poll.
I'm good to keep going. We could do a break and keep going, or because there is still a lot to the plot.
Yeah, there's more stuff I'd like to talk about before we go. And even though we are at the end of our hopefully 1 hour time slot, Grace, what about you? Are you good to keep going?
I actually gotta go. So
okay, well, Grace, if you gotta go, you gotta go. We will.
Sorry.
We'll continue. It's all right. You know, sometimes it doesn't quite work for an hour. All right, we will see you later, Grace.
See y'all next week. Bye bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So
you're going to do a music break?
No, I don't think so. I think we'll
just keep going.
We'll just keep going. We will get through this. So we talked about Krug a lot already, right? But I wanted to mention him a little bit more just because he is the villain of the movie. And, you know, there's a little bit of silliness with the my lord and the why did he kill his girlfriend? Like, there was no reason for that. Maybe he was just looking for an excuse to break up with her. We'll never know. but I appreciated that his motivation was very clear, and he seemed reasonably competent in the way he was going about it. Like, you know, he's...
Was that David? I see that. Well, to me, and like I love Christopher Lloyd as an actor. I love this character, the characterization, the mannerism, the portrayal of Krug's, Christopher Lloyd's version of a Klingon. But in terms of like strategy, motivation, you know, I always kind of was torn with Krug because he always seemed like egotistical and grandiose, and obviously you could think, okay, well, all Klingons are going to be, you know, boisterous and you know, over the top or whatever. But I mean, it always looked like, because here's another example of Krug. Like, he beams down to the Genesis planet, mm-hmm. and he sees that big worm thing, and it's not like, okay, there's a life form there. He has to pick it up and like test himself with it, and I must best my, you know, this beast. And then he just throws it aside, and once it's done, it's like, okay, now on to the next thing. Right. It always seemed like...
And he even contacts his ship, Bridge, nothing happening here, you know, after he's had to defeat this giant man-squeezing slug.
Remembered as the slug attacking him, but that's not actually what happens now that I watch it again. so that's a good point.
No, he likes... It's like... And just always going like... too far, like over the top, you know, trying and in terms of like when Kirk beams down and he's trying to reason with Krug, you know, obviously you may not always be able to reason and logic through with other aliens, but there's times where Kirk is like, you know, this Spock needs help, you know, beam him up, and he's like, no, just because you want it, I'm not going to do that. It's like, it's always spiteful and grandiose, and like I don't know, I love that character, but then at the same time I see flaws in it that I can't hold Krug up to be like, that's a quintessential Klingon, that's, you know, an example of a good Klingon, an honorable Klingon,
right?
And of course the whole honor code, you know, develops over time later, so that they didn't have that to work with. But even then, it's like Krug is definitely got issues and flaws and not always thinking you know, the most tactically, I guess.
Well, that was the thing that annoyed me, was that up until this point he's been completely focused on Genesis. Like, Genesis was all that mattered. And then suddenly when he beams down to the planet to like confront Kirk, he kind of throws that all away so he can have a fist fight with Kirk. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey Kirk, tell me, you know, the secret of Genesis. And it's like, Krug, do you really think he's gonna be able to explain Genesis in like the 5 minutes you have before the planet explodes?
Yelling,
yeah, why
over
not
the,
just beam them both up and then get the information?
Yeah, I mean,
I agree with. I think David made a really good point about that. Krug, up until the point where he sends his crew over to the Enterprise, has been, he's been the fairly single-minded commander, and he often says, "I trust my instincts." You know, he acts spontaneously, and I think a couple things are important there. One is that early on, there's a reference when he's all intimately whispering to his lieutenant that they're kind of going against the Empire here. They're a little bit, they're maverick Klingons. They're going off to find Genesis, while Genesis itself is evidently a big galactic upheaval mystery issue, and nobody knows what to do, and these guys are going to take advantage and go in. So he's already kind of a maverick, mm-hmm. and the reference to instinct, it makes sense for a Klingon commander to say, I trust my instincts. But then what happened to those well-honed instincts? He didn't suspect Kirk's trick. He sends his whole crew over there without thinking that maybe this is a setup. Why does he assume that this is going to work?
Yeah, it's the whole, especially like when the whole ship was abandoned, it was just like, what is going on here?
And there's the point where at that point they're like, you know, but we're 40 against 400, and he's like, we're Klingons.
Yeah,
it's right. Kind of like overconfidence and overestimating, and the fact that, like, okay, you need, definitely Klingons are strong and they could probably take on multiple target, you know, opponents or whatever, but that just shows that wasn't good tactics either, or good instincts. And it kind of seemed like, here's this guy, this Klingon, like a glory seeker, and, you know, wanting to, you know, make people call him my lord, and the way he sits above everybody else, like that type of thing. And so he's like, Genesis, this is an amazing, you know, super destructive thing. I must have it for me, because it will bring me, like, glory and make me stronger. And then that's his single-minded purpose on that side. But then it's almost like with how he had to, like, prove himself to himself, like, to against that worm creature. It's almost like Kirk down on the planet becomes a bigger, better version of that worm serpent thing. That, like, now I must prove myself against you, Kirk. And then he loses focus of, I must have the Genesis. You know?
Yeah, he's too easily distracted from his mission.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I also feel like that big confrontation between Krug and Kirk, there's, like, a couple of points where they sort of assume that these are two characters who have had, like, this great rivalry, and this is, like, their big confrontation. And it's like, you know, these guys only met each other like 15 minutes ago. And, you know, granted, in that time,
yep.
Krug killed Kirk's son, and then Kirk, you know, killed Krug's crew, which is Kirk killed Krug's crew. Okay, that's a tongue twister.
Wow.
So, you know, a lot has happened in that 15 minutes, but it still felt like this was supposed to have a certain, like, gravitas to it that it didn't.
Well, at the same time, it's almost like two big egos butting heads, because just imagine, you know, if the fates were twisted, if it was Captain Esteban that Krug was dealing with, he would have, like, kowtowed and, you know, submitted and, you know, maybe tried to fight but not been able to and got defeated, whatever. But it's Krug with his crazy big ego going up against Kirk, and Kirk would definitely not back down. He would not, you know, not in that situation, especially after his son was just killed. So I think they weren't longtime rivals like Khan, but,
yeah,
you know, two big alpha, you know, alphas going at each other.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right, and I every time I think about the hostage thing, it just brings me back to being so upset that Savick just stands there while David gets murdered. Like,
and also doesn't mobilize Spock at all. She doesn't try. I mean, he tosses a Klingon across the campfire when he doesn't want to be touched, right? So there was never any effort made to use that incredible Vulcan strength to overcome these two Klingons that are holding them hostage.
Right.
You know, like maybe it wouldn't have worked, but she could have, you know, clearly she and Spock had a bond. She, you know, some equivalent of get 'em, Spock. Might have worked. Might have saved David.
Or even just, hey, one Klingon is knife fighting David. The other one is distracted by staring at this knife fight.
Right.
I am a trained Starfleet officer. We know Starfleet officers are trained in hand-to-hand combat. And she's a Vulcan. We know Vulcans are really strong.
Right.
And, like, worst case scenario,
I'm just going to stand here.
Worst case scenario is they all get killed, and then Krug can no longer use them as a leverage against Kirk to acquire Genesis. Which, as far as Savick knows, is the only reason Kirk hasn't blown Krug away. So that's even the logical thing to do. And it's just such a waste. And, I mean, they try to, like, the biggest moment Savick gets in this movie is when she's, like, I guess sort of becoming, she sort of becomes Spock's mentor when he's all, like, messed up. But a lot of that doesn't work because Spock doesn't talk. Like, there's no real interaction between them other than the implied, the implication that they had sex.
Right.
That's, like, the only thing going on there, and it's weak. It's weak sauce is what it is.
I'm with you.
Well, I just kind
of, yeah.
Do you think in some ways, going back to the Wrath of Khan, and it kind of even showed, in the Wrath of Khan, it implied a history that we didn't see before, but with Spock being her, like, mentor, coach, advocate, you know, trying to, like, take her as a protege type of thing, that now that maybe she just, and I'm probably reaching because I'm just now thinking of all this, but maybe she didn't try to, you know, attack the Klingons or go after you know, that opportunity, because now she's seeing her former mentor, her former almost father figure, if you want to stretch it. Now he's vulnerable. He's, you know, back to a child or a younger person. He's in flux with the planet. Like, she wouldn't want to risk. And because in a way, they had lost Spock. So she lost her mentor.
Yeah.
Now here's the chance to get him back. But he's so super vulnerable. Like, she wouldn't want to risk doing anything that might jeopardize the return of Spock, you know, because now we have a chance to have him back. I don't know. I'm just now thinking, but that might be a stretch. Cause
yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, go ahead. It's
probably the best face you can put on it.
Yeah,
is that she was She was saving herself in order to protect Spock.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I can see that, but I don't think it quite works. I mean, because again, this is all like, we're all going super deep into this analysis of like what's maybe a 30-second scene, right? And so on the surface, what it looks like is Savick is just very passive. And then we dig into it. It's like, well, maybe it's because she was protecting Spock. But I mean, A, that isn't Spock. Like, that's some guy whose DNA is the same as Spock's. But like, she doesn't know anything about the Katra business. As far as she's concerned, that never happened.
Yeah, but she is. I mean, he can only be Spock because Spock was the only Vulcan buried on the planet.
No. I mean that his mind, as far as she knows, he has none of Spock's memories or personalities. He's just a blank slate who happens to look like Spock. Because she doesn't know about the Katra thing.
Or it could almost be like that's just like a mindless clone. Like, it's Spock's DNA reconstructed. But that's not Spock, you know. With
I still think experience. Your point about her loyalty and her need to protect him is a good one.
Yeah.
But I don't. It seems to me that might have been all the more reason to spring into action, because you don't know who's going to do next. He might kill them all.
Yeah, there's not really any reason to believe Krug will let them go once he has Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of that, I want to talk about the plot just to wrap things up a little bit. This is another part where the movie kind of really stumbles, because it's very unclear what is happening in certain points. Like, if you think about it, it's like, wait, so you need to go to Vulcan to get Spock's body. And it's like, why? Because they make pretty clear that the Katra can only be restored to a living body, and Spock's body was dead. And as far as Kirk knew, it had burned up in the atmosphere, because they make that whole line about how, well, it's intact. That's weird. And it's like, well, it soft landed because the gravitational fields were in flux. So it's very unclear to me what Kirk was actually going back to Genesis to do. Like, what did he think he was going to accomplish by doing that?
I think he was just acting on faith. That's how I made sense of it, that the combination of McCoy's distress, and then he finds out that McCoy's got Spock's Katra. And so in order to save McCoy, he has to find a way to get that mind out of McCoy's mind. And then the meeting with Sarah. And he finds that
there's a chance to have a body.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I just think I think it's one of the things that makes the drama of the buddy movie thing work, is that he is willing to risk everything on the outside chance that this might work.
Yeah.
He even tells that to, I think, that admiral. Like, he says, he's telling them, like, I need the Enterprise to go back to Vulcan. And that admiral's like, you don't really believe this, right? And I'm like, I don't believe all this Vulcan mysticism. Kirk says, you don't have to believe it. I'm not even sure I believe it. But if there's even a chance, I must try.
Right. But, It bothers me, because the implication of that is that this was Spock's, like, his plan to avoid death somehow, was that somehow by putting his Katra in McCoy, they could then put it back in his radiation-ravaged body. And it's like, well, that makes his sacrifice at the end of Wrath of Khan actually mean less than it did. It's like this weird circle.
Well, on watching it again, I did kind of have a thought, and it's similar kind of like that. Like, it was weird, but I don't know if it was the same what you were just saying. But I looked at it, because especially when it shows the scene, like, aside from us remembering what happened, like, you get to see the death scene again. And then, especially after Spock, I mean, after Sarek comes in, he's watching the actual video, like, of, you know, the recording, like, almost like the security cam video of what happened. Spock is about to go in, and he's, you know, arguing with McCoy, and it's like, okay, fine, McCoy, you win. McCoy turns his back, he pinches him, puts the, you know, mind meld. McCoy's knocked out. He goes right into the radiation machine and basically from there dies. Spock never told anybody that first that he put the Katra into McCoy. Second, you know, what it meant, you know, that this is all my, you know, knowledge, my awareness, my personality. This is all of my essence. And so from Spock's perspective, he's doing a self-sacrificing you know, action by killing, letting himself die, killing, you know, doing that to save the ship. So unless it's just like a last ditch effort, like, oh, I should probably do something with my Katra, I'll put it in McCoy. There's like no plan. Like he never tells anybody, hey, I'm going to die. My body's going to burn up or wither. And, you know, but at least my essence can be given to some Vulcan mystic who would, you know, retain my memories and my awareness and my knowledge. He just puts it into McCoy and doesn't tell anybody. It messes up McCoy. And then we get this whole, you know, without Spock ever really knowing it, then unfolds all this, you know, stuff that everything had to fall in the right place at the right time for them to get a body and take him to Vulcan and do this old style ritual that, you know, hasn't been done for so long or whatever. It just seemed weird that, like, why would Spock do that to McCoy and, you know, put his Katra into somebody else without telling them what it, the implications of it all and like what it meant, what to do, go climb, go take, you know, this person to Saleya and something. It just seemed weird to me that this was all added after that con.
We know why he did. It was his revenge for all those arguments he lost.
right. But I also think it makes us wonder, what is it we don't know about Vulcans as a species? Do they all do this when they're about to die? They give somebody their Katra? Well, they surely don't all expect to be reunited with their body because, as David says, we're told this is a very old ritual that's not been used in centuries. So they clearly don't do it very often. So what do they do with all those Katras? Or is Spock the only one that did this? And if so, why? I mean, it's like it raises a question about the species of Vulcan that I don't know that I've ever seen an answer to.
Well, they actually answered this question in Enterprise, as I remember. There's the fourth season episode, it's actually a three episode arc, where Archer ends up with Surik's Katra in his brain. They kind of establish that the Katra isn't intended as a way to resurrect yourself. It's supposed to be like, you can send it back to Vulcan so that other Vulcans can learn from your experiences and your memories, is the idea. Huh. Which I approve of, like, sure, that makes sense. But in that context, it's even weirder that Sarek is insisting that Kirk go back to Genesis for Spock's body. The only way really to explain it is that Sarek has read the script and knows what's going to happen at the end. You know, like Sarek is prophetic somehow. And so that whole thing is kind of strange.
Well, it certainly makes me wonder about all this quote Vulcan mysticism is, where do they store all these Katras? Do they have like jars in their, you know, on Mount Saleya? And they must have a lot of them. How do you consult them?
Spock was able to mind meld with a Horta, which is kind of rock stuff. And we've seen him, you know, in the one episode, he touched a cave wall and it kind of projected his mind to the Kelvin who was standing on the outside of the cave. Maybe they put it in crystals or something and people go mind meld with the mountain and the rocks.
That sounds good. I'll go with that.
Bunch of rocks just full of Vulcan mines. It certainly raises a lot of questions that the film is not interested in answering, that's for sure. All right. So I think if you guys are up for it, I think we can give our final wrap-ups and sort of opinions of this on this movie. Unless there's anything else you think we need to hit before we do that.
I'm good.
All right. The only thing I could think of that I kind of thought about saying was, this was the first time we see the Klingon knife dagger with the two blades that pop out. Mm-hmm. it was made for this, you know, the first debut of the Klingon dagger, but it wasn't named until long time later in the Next Generation episode Birthright. Is that's when we find out, oh, it's a Duktog, and we've seen it in all the different movies, and they never named it, but it was like the first time we get the Klingon iconic, you know, knife, mm-hmm. The language. So yeah, that's about it.
All right, Kathy, what's your final wrap up on this movie?
Well, I guess I've said this already, but I like it better every time I see it, and it's because I appreciate the way that the campiness functions to make an otherwise kind of nonsensical plot work, because it really doesn't make a lot of sense to have stars who continually rebel against the organization they work for and are continually praised for it at the end. And the only way that can work is to set up a way of relating to Starfleet that lets you laugh at it and mock it and want Kirk to defy it sometimes, and then other times find it an admirable organization that's worth rejoining.
Yeah.
So I think they did that really well.
That's fair. I think for me, this movie is, like, it's an okay movie to watch. It's not one of the bad ones. It's just, it's okay. I think it's important because of all the things it establishes. Like, you know, David pointed out, this is the first time we see the Klingon knife. This is the first time we see the Klingon armor. This is the first time we see the Klingon disruptors, really. Their disruptor pistol. First time we see the Bird of Prey.
Bird of Prey, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of these things are things that appeared in this movie, which most people regard as kind of lackluster, but would be incredibly important shaping what the rest of Star Trek would look like. And, like, Katras, too. Katras were established in this episode, and they play an important role in a couple of other scripts.
Was this the first movie to show...
Is this the first time we see a Targ?
No. That thing is actually not a Targ, believe it or not.
Oh.
Yeah, it's sometimes called Monster Dog, other times Lizard Dog. Mm-hmm. But is this the first time that we see basically Earth Starbase 1 or like
the
big, you know, mushroom Starbase? Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that ever in like Wrath of Khan?
Nope.
Or the motion picture?
First time we see it.
Because that became iconic for even Next Generation. It's in Star Trek Online. Like, that's established as that's the big, you know, giant space station right above Earth. And I like the design, but I thought, wait, is that the first time?
Yeah, and that shot that they use when the Enterprise is going into the station gets used a lot of times later, replaced with the Enterprise D. There are a bunch of things that get established in this movie, and like the death of David will end up playing a huge role in Star Trek 3, or no, excuse me, Star Trek 6.
Right.
Which we'll get to.
Yeah, it establishes.
And so I appreciate it for all the things that it established that we might not have without this movie. But at the same time, I feel like this movie was a waste, in particular the way it treated David and Savick, who were two side characters that I think could have gone on to greater things if they hadn't both received such lackluster writing in this movie. Because, I mean, I don't think it's much of a coincidence we never saw Savick again after this, except for, like, we see her, like, a little bit in the beginning of Star Trek IV. But, you know, it just feels like that, you know, if she had had a better showing in this movie, we might have had more of a motivation to have her in Star Trek VI. But, all right, so that's my final take. So, Kathy, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, as always.
It's always good to have you. Now that we've figured out how to get you here on Skype, it'll be something we'll have to do again later. For anyone who wants to email us, you can do so at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. And when you download the MP3 version of this, I will include a special audio file sent over from Data Logan, which is becoming a bit of a tradition. I appreciate that. So until then, this is All Things Trek signing off.
Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's data log.
One is my name. The other is not.
20 October 2013. One of the first images that comes to my mind when I think of Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, is Kirk up on that ledge, kicking Kruge in the face. I have had enough of you! And every time, kicking him a little harder and harder, until finally, that last blow, he kicks really hard, and he crashes through the Enterprise, making her turn into a fireball and crash to a planet. Well, of course, it doesn't happen that way in the movie, but it did in a comic book called Dead of Honor. That's how the comic book starts, is Kirk having this dream where he's combining the Kruge kick with the destruction of the Enterprise. And then that image always sat with me. The comic book's pretty good. Cruz never seemed like much of a bad guy in the movie. It was certainly a lot more impactful on the story that the Enterprise was destroyed. So it doesn't really surprise me that that's what Kirk would dream about later on. That's what really affected him. And of course, the death of his son, which was also part of that comic. Star Trek 3 is a bit unique for Star Trek movies because it is pretty personal. The entire story is really just about the group of characters that we know and love going out and doing something for themselves, their own friends and family. Kruj is a very minor character in the story, basically just thrown in to give some kind of villain to the story when they didn't really need one. The plot's definitely very character-driven. A lot of the lines from the movie really stick with you. Don't call me tiny. The answer is no. I am therefore growing anyway. Up your shaft. My God, Bones. What have I done? What you do, what you've always done, turned death into a fighting chance for life. I do not deserve to live. Fine, I'll kill you later. I like that little moment on the bridge when Kirk asks if there's a ship following him, and you hear Spock's voice off the side saying, "Scanning. Indication negative at this time." And then each of the characters all realize what they've just heard and turned to look in that direction one at a time. And then it's just McCoy at the scanner going, "Did I get it right?" Other scenes that really stick out in my memory from this movie is Mr. Adventure in the Closet. The first version of extreme Klingon cleavage we get to see. That weird Klingon lizard dog that is not a Targ. The fact that Chekhov's costume changes during the escape. As soon as the space dock doors open, like he ran to his quarters and changed his clothes for some reason. The movie gives us a couple examples of that axiom of Star Trek. That all the Starfleet officers who are not members of Kirk's crew have some kind of major character flaw. The by-the-book Esteban, the riding crop styles. Even Starfleet Commander Morrow, who gets two significant things wrong. First, he says the Enterprise is 20 years old, when she's not. She's really more like 40. And then during a conversation with Kirk, he says to Kirk that your life and career stands for rationality, not emotional chaos. Who's he kidding? It is a really powerful scene when Kirk learns that David has been killed and how he's handling it there on the bridge, and it takes him a while to respond. Plus that whole thing with him backing up a little bit and then missing the chair and falling on the deck. That was something that Shatner improvised on set. Genesis? Genesis allowed is not. It's planet forbidden. Okay, thanks for listening to my ramblings. Keep up the good work and your movie review. Data out.